It's the week movie fanatics and filmgoers treasure the opening of the Cleveland International Film Festival. During the next hour, we'll take an overview of the festivities, hearing from the artistic director about what to expect this year. We have a preview of some of the various films showing, particularly those with Ohio or Ukrainian ties, as CIFF partnered with Ukraine's Odessa Film Festival to feature several films from that nation. And we'll take a deep look at a film all about an unsung segment of the healthcare population, Filipino nurses, who make up sizable swaths of the occupation. Welcome to The Sound of Ideas, I'm Rick Jackson. Before we darken the lights to theater settings, we're continuing our Get to NEO a Leader series. Joining me is the chairperson of the Board of Trustees of Concord Township, Morgan McIntosh. Concord is a Lake County community of about 18,000 folks, very different than some of the other cities and towns we've featured in the series. We'll ask Morgan more about a boom in projects and improvements going on there. But first, we have national and local news. It is The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Rick Jackson. Thank you for joining us. It's been almost a year now since we started our Get to NEO a Leader series, where we talk to mayors and city managers in communities large and small about the places they lead. We started the series shortly after IdeaStream Public Media expanded our news coverage to 22 counties last March. Our station now reaches an area covering about 3 million people, stretching across northeast Ohio from Ashtabula and Trumbull in the east to Erie and Huron in the west, from urban counties that touch Lake Erie, like Lorain Lake and Cuyahoga, to the more rural southern counties like Holmes, Stark, and Tuscarawas. That means there's a lot of communities out there that many of us know very little about, and the aim for this series is to connect and inform us as we live across this region. In the last year, we've spoken to leaders in Summit, Cuyahoga, Lorain, Portage, Stark, Mahoning, Geauga, and Medina counties. A lot of leaders, a lot of counties, but there's a lot more to go. Next up, we're going to add a new leader to the list and a new county as we head to Lake County today to talk to the chairperson of the Board of Trustees of Concord Township. That's Morgan McIntosh. He joins me here in studio. Thank you for coming down.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Appreciate this. Folks, if you'd like to join the conversation, ask Morgan questions. You can find out more about what's going on in Concord Township, 866-578-0903. You can tweet us. We are at Sound of Ideas. You can email us, soi@ideastream.org. And just so you folks know, the area surrounding the intersection of I-90 and Highway 44, 30 miles northeast of downtown Cleveland, is where Concord Township sits. You've been residing there more than two decades. How'd you wind up in the township?
I actually moved to Ohio in the 80s with my parents, and they got divorced, and I left the area for a while. But when I returned, lived in Mayfield Heights for a while, and then decided I wanted to relocate and live someplace, and went back to Concord Township. Been there ever since.
For those people who are not familiar, give me the elevator pitch on why we should all live in Concord.
Well, Concord is one of the fastest growing communities in Lake County. Right now, we have six different developments in various stages of completion that will result in another 360 plus homes in Concord Township. And the last 20 years, we've seen a lot of growth in Concord Township. It is one of the up and coming communities. We're 24 square miles. The thing that I think that a lot of people like most about Concord Township is the access. You've got State Route 44 and I-90 running right through the more or less the middle of the township, and the 90 and 44 area, we have a business district, and that's where a lot of our retail and a lot of the conveniences and the things that residents want, grocery stores, shopping, and fast, you know, quick food and restaurants and so forth are right there. But 2 or 3 minutes one direction or the other, and you feel like you're in the country. And there's a phrase that used to be uttered around. I haven't heard it so much. But it's semi-rural, we used to talk about. So you can drive down the road and feel like you're in the country, and in 5 minutes you can be at a nice grocery store or a nice restaurant or grab a quick coffee at a Starbucks.
So men are in Painesboro, your suburbs.
Yeah, right.
Okay. You were the president of a company based in Willoughby, Omega One. You remain a consultant there. Why did suddenly in life you want to go from business to becoming a public servant?
Well, I was working in the business. It was a family business for a while, and just always wanted to serve the community. I'd been on the zoning board of the Concord Township community since 2009, and I was friends with all of the former trustees, and really wasn't approved of what they were doing, liked what they were doing, and at some point, you know, roads came along and they chose different trajectories. And so an opportunity came to run for trustee, and I leapt at the opportunity. It was something I really wanted to do. And I've just had a great time the last 3 years being a leader in the community and getting to work on those things that make a difference.
We talk about leaders. We've had city managers on. We've had mayors on. We've not had a trustee on before. Explain for listeners what's different about a township trustee rather than a city manager.
Well, a city manager runs, you know, a city and then reports to a city council, and the council has to. So you've got that, or you have a strong mayor that has to put their ideas before the board, and there has to be consensus among council. And the trustees operate the township. There's three of us, sort of like the Lake County still has the three commissioner model, mm-hmm. and it's the same sort of a thing where things have to come before the board, and we oversee everything. In Concord Township, we have hire and operate an administrator who functions sort of as the city manager, but reports to us. We appoint or hire that individual, as well as, you know, the other department heads to run various departments in the township. And so I like the form of government. I really enjoy working with my fellow trustees, Carl Dondorfer and Amy Lucci. We have a great, we've developed a nice, great culture together as the former board had, and work well, and it's efficient. Not a lot of layers to go through, not a lot of processes. Townships are very lean, budgetary-wise. We get a lot done with very little. And we serve one of the largest communities in Lake County, and Concord Township has the second highest property values in all of Lake County, right behind the city of Mentor. And we don't have near the, you know, commercial property and and the population that they do. We're not a city yet. We're very equal in some of the same kinds of demands and challenges that we face, and we do it with a lot less. So we're very proud of that, and we're very proud of our community.
It's not just fiscal that you oversee. There's other things going on.
Correct. We operate a road department. By high-rise code, we're mandated to operate a cemetery. We have a fire department, and we subcontract with the Lake County Sheriff's Department for law enforcement in Concord Township. And we have a lot of challenges with that as far as being a growing community.
You mentioned the fact that you were on the Zoning Commission for, what, a decade or so?
Pretty close, mm-hmm. 10 years.
What were you involved with then? What do you see different now? This is, I guess, a step up.
It is a step up, I suppose, in the sense that the Zoning Commission is a recommending body, and the trustees have ultimate responsibility and authority over the zoning code. So it's a little more responsible, because you would sit in a public hearing, and if people didn't like, we would say, well, it's a recommendation. You know, you need mm-hmm. to make your final appeal to the trustees. And there's been times when things come up and the former board would overrule or make adjustments, and now I sit in that seat. But when you ascend, you end up very quickly being in the purview of those things that make a lot of sense, and you understand why. But I don't have that. It's you got to stand on your conviction a little bit more and stand up to the idea of why you want to do something, as opposed to, well, we're making a recommendation to the Board of Trustees, and it's ultimately up to them.
866-578-0903 if you want to talk to Morgan McIntosh about Concord Township. You said something kind of interesting a minute ago. You said we're not a city, and you paused and said yet. Is there a movement from anybody in the township that maybe it's time to incorporate as you approach 20,000 people?
No, you know, that's something that's interesting. People will say all the time, well, they want to become a city. And honestly, the last thing I would want to do is change over. I think the residents in our community would raise quite a stir.
The semi-rural residents.
Yeah.
Right?
There's a lot of new people growing, and they call Concord a city. You'll get an email or a phone call, and a resident, well, can the city this, can the city that? And you're constantly politely saying, okay, well, we're a township. But the nice thing is, when they're talking to you, the rubber hits the road with us. It's me, you know, connecting with one of my other peers and saying, what do you think about this? And we very efficiently decide what we're going to do on that, and we execute, as opposed to more layers of bureaucracy in a city. I'm not interested in that. I like being a trustee. Like I said before, I see the, and it's not, some entities need it, whatever. I just think in our case, it's a little more cumbersome that's necessary. We're doing just fine in Concord as a township, and I think most of our residents prefer that. Case in point, we looked a couple years ago at putting together legislation to go out for a bid for township-wide trash hauling, ultimately saying, hey, we mm-hmm. can lower the cost of this, we can bring more services, we can lower the traffic on our roads by having only one hauler. So instead of three or four different haulers on any given street, we have one. And the flood of emails saying, I moved to a township, you don't get to pick my trash. We never even bothered to put the bid out because the backlash was so strong. And I would suggest that if we made a move to become a city, we'd probably get that kind of backlash, if not more.
It's kind of how it's supposed to work.
Yeah, so we're going to stay put.
Okay. You were talking about the fact that there's housing developments going on, but you've got some other big projects I wanted to talk about there. The new fire station project. You're hoping to build two new fire stations, spending, what, $13 million?
Right. That is that was a big project that was taken up by the my fellow trustees in 2020. There was a ballot initiative put on in 2019 at the same time I ran as a trustee, and it didn't pass. So we took that up during the pandemic at a time when there was a lot of uncertainty about the economy and everything, and it was definitely a challenge, but we really feel like it was the best decision. The facilities that we have were commissioned in 1966, and when you hit it right on the head, when you say there's a community that's touching 20,000 people and you're operating out of a facility that was the first floor for a volunteer fire station and the second floor was a community center, and when your auxiliary station was originally just a service garage that had been added onto three times for a few thousand square feet, and it's now a full-time, and now it's a full-time fire department. I mean, if the residents of Concord saw the conditions our firefighters live in, again, I'll go back to that second highest property value is fastest growing community in Lake County thing. It's a project that needed to be done.
It's also the kind of thing that would attract even more people to come to see that you have that top-notch level of fire protection.
Well, our board has been very focused on public safety. We focused on that, definitely needed to build those fire stations and got that done in 2020, got the process started in 21 and broke ground early last year. So we took care of that one. We were working closely with the Sheriff's Department to add patrols. But when you look at how hard and difficult it is to hire public safety firefighters and law enforcement right now, as a former business owner, you need to look at the kinds of things that attract people, and pay is certainly part of it. But I think, you know, I looked at corporate culture when I was running a business and what is it that makes people happy here. Well, when you think about the same dynamics in a community, you want to establish the good culture in the community, but within your working environment as well. And so when you have that community, and we wanted to give good working conditions and safe. One of the things that 30% of the increase of square footage for both facilities is dedicated to decontamination services. So the firefighters have, and I spent a lot of time with our chief. I toured multiple fire stations before we undertook the project and before we decided to go to the ballot for the levy to understand what was all involved in that and why. And it's the bottom line is it's a dangerous job and it's getting harder to get people to want to do it. So developing a first-class facility to attract quality. The one thing we hear from our residents all the time is how professional and what a great job our firefighters do, and they do a fantastic job. But if we want to keep that level of service, we need to have a facility that's going to attract the A players in the industry.
Mm-hmm. The last person in this series was the mayor of Orange, and we were talking about the schools there. And it's interesting because six different communities feed into the Orange schools. You're the exact opposite. Your kids go to Chardon, to Riverside, Mentor. Is it difficult as the trustees to try and deal with three different sets of school boards, three different sets of schools, because you want to keep your kids safe? Every school is spending money now to try and keep the kids safe.
Yeah, well, I mean, I want to clarify one point. We realistically have two. It would be Riverside and Mentor. Okay. There's one street that probably has 10 houses on it.
Because of Chardon.
Okay. Chardon, yeah. It's relatively no number. And we do, there's quite a difference between the two communities as far as funding goes. You've got Mentor, which is it's as big, and then you've got Riverside. Mm-hmm. We try to support the schools as much as we can. There's been a lot of controversy about a lot of school issues, and we try to keep a distance of it. We're not board members. We're not there making policy. And we work closely with the Sheriff's Department, at least as far as, you know, our patrol in Concord Township goes. And they're the ones that are working with the Riverside School District. And, of course, Mentor Police Department is working with the Mentor schools. And we don't have a lot to do with the Mentor Police Department and the Mentor that side of it, more involved with the Sheriff's Department than that. But I think we have a great relationship all around in that area, and I think both those boards and schools are doing a good job.
Folks are invited to email in questions, soi@ideastream.org, or call us 866-578-0903. Susan wrote in to ask you about the history of Concord Township. She said her family settled there in the 1850s, had a woolen mill on Fay Road. There is a lot of family connection that goes back through Concord. A lot of people have been there, as this family, for a long time.
There is a lot of history. We just celebrated our bicentennial last year in 2022 and had a year of service, different programs. We had tours around the community. We went to all the historic places. Our rec director, who retired at the end of last year, and one of our volunteers, Deb Esker and Dan Maxson, wrote a book about Concord that's available for sale on Amazon, and the township can, if people are interested. But there is a lot of history. We have the former sheriff of Lake County lives in Concord Township, was born in the house he lives in, and retired as the sheriff several years ago and lives there. My predecessor operates an airport, was a trustee for the longest serving trustee in Concord Township history, has lived there a long time, operated the airport. There's just Girdled Road was named for the girdling, the tree operation back there back in the day. It's just the stories are endless. And the interesting, fun thing, we have a historical building, the Old Stone School, which is just north of Town Hall and Ravenna Road, full of history. Our volunteers there, all kinds of great stories, and they're so alive. Our cemetery, we've got people that are buried there that fought in the Revolutionary War, and Concord Township was named after the Battle of Lexington in the Revolutionary War. So I think the thing that's interesting and I enjoy so much about Concord is how alive the history is in our community.
And you're also staying up abreast with what's new. The Kellogg Creek Restoration Project, that's about $1.5 million, a dam removal that is going to bring back some more natural elements.
Right. Actually, when I moved to Concord first in the early 80s as a child, I lived on a street that was on Brightwood Lake, and I used to swim in what used to be the lake. Mm-hmm. So, that, of course, that project came in, and mostly entirely funded by Ohio EPA dollars. Right. And I remember that dam and remember everything. And so, of course, when they took it out, and that was due to the fact that cost of keeping it up was just onerous. So the former board went and was able to work with and get grant money to slowly move that project to fruition. And I think everyone seems pretty happy with the progress of it. I visited the site last fall after the lake was drained and stood there. And it was just sort of interesting for all the years I've been in Concord to look at a lake that's now being gradually returned to a stream. And that project will complete later this spring or early summer.
Right. I was going to say, that's still ongoing.
Yeah, I guess I haven't been there in a while, but my understanding is it takes quite a bit of time because we started working on that, dealing with the wildlife in the lake and whatnot, 2 summers ago. And so it's been a process that will take a long time. But once it's done, I think we're really looking forward to getting it back, because stormwater management and water management is a big issue.
It is.
So the more you can get back to the natural state of things, when I was on the zoning board and the trustees took up riparian setbacks, water regulation, just to deal with so much water. And this is just one of those things, getting things back to the way their nature intended them is definitely something we're excited about.
As if you weren't busy enough, you already this year were appointed to serve as the Lake County Grand Jury Foreperson for 3 months. That's still ongoing too, right?
Yes.
And I can't talk about a lot that goes on in the grand jury, but does it give you better insight into what's happening in Lake County?
It does. It's I started out I intended to go into a career of law enforcement. I did an internship with a Metropolitan Police Department up in Minnesota and spent 5 years mm-hmm. as a volunteer in law enforcement. So a lot of it was sort of dusting off some old knowledge that I thought, well, it's good that it's still there. And I've really enjoyed the process of seeing a different aspect of my community. And it's interesting to see the reaction of people that I serve with being surprised. And it's surprising to me, although more of a reminder, because I've seen some of the stuff that's going on. And our prosecutor's office does a fantastic job. They've really come in and done a great job laying out their cases, and they've made the job of serving as a jury person very mm-hmm. easy. I've enjoyed the engagement and the service.
And it gets you connected with the places, Kirtland, Perry, know, not just Mentor and Painesville. So you really get to see Lake County at its best.
Yes.
In grand jury, maybe not at its best. So what else would you want to tell people about what's going on in Concord? Why should I come see you?
We're doing a lot of growth. That corridor between I-90 and Auburn Road, Crile. I also serve on the Joint Economic Development District, the JED board.
No, you're not too busy.
That's okay. That's a cooperative board that manages JED is a taxing district that we work in partnership with Concord and Painesville together, and that is the economic development engine of Concord Township. So that's where we're focusing. And there's a strategic plan that was developed over the years, and it's focused on developing that corridor of business. Again, back to the focus on semi-rural, where we're trying to create that balance of our residential communities, but yet still having the amenities. When I first lived in Concord, you had to drive everywhere for everything. I mean, you wanted a cup of coffee, you wanted to go grocery shopping. I mean, there was a hardware store and a McDonald's, and that was about it. And so now there's a lot more amenities and there's more things there. And that's, the JED is working to make that happen. We've got a hospital.
I was going to say, you didn't always have a hospital.
Well, it used to be two, but now that University Hospital's required Lake Health, it's all just sort of one medical campus mm-hmm. under the banner of University Hospital. And University's just recently announced an almost $2 million investment. And we're getting a level two NICU. And all of the birthing units are being consolidated at the TriPoint facility there. So we're seeing more of that development. We have two nationally branded retailers in that corridor, and they're the top performers in the East metropolitan area of Cleveland, outshining most of their peers in neighboring communities. So there's a lot of traffic. There's a lot happening in Concord, and there's more and more. Recent years, we continue to see more interest in the commercial development of that district, which is going to bring more services and amenities so you can live in a beautiful community. It's got good schools. That's 20, 30 minutes from Cleveland, real close to the lake. You're in a very vibrant part of the Lake County, and more is coming.
Okay. Sounds good. I'm ready to pack up and go. Okay. Morgan, I want to thank you for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
Morgan McIntosh is the chairperson of the Board of Trustees in Concord Township as part of our Get to Eniowa Leader Series. Hey, folks, what town, city, or village should we bring you for the next series? Email your answers to soi@ideastream.org. Make your suggestions there. Thanks for being here. After the break, I look forward to the Cleveland International Film Festival kicking off tomorrow right here in Playhouse Square. You're listening to The Sound of Ideas. You're with The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Rick Jackson. This week, the Cleveland International Film Festival, also known as CIFF, opens in Playhouse Square. 47th annual edition will be in person March 22nd through April 1st, then moves online for a week of streaming through April 9th. We have a preview of some of the various films showing, particularly those with Ohio or Ukrainian ties, as CIFF partnered with Ukraine's Odessa Film Festival to feature several films from there this year. Let's hear now from CIFF Artistic Director Mallory Martin in conversation with IdeaStream Public Media's Carrie Wise.
A quick pop quiz. Do you have the official count of how many features and how many shorts are showing?
Yes, I do, actually. So we are showing 121 feature films this year. And through including our Film Slam program, which is our mini festival within the festival for middle school and high school students, we'll be showing 199 shorts overall between Film Slam and the rest of the festival.
Well, let's talk about some of the Ohio films. Were you aware of the history of Toledo's women's football team before seeing We Are the Troopers?
No, not at all. And I'm so thrilled that we're going to be having the world premiere of the film, too.
Yeah, this is a letter here from the Pro Football Hall of Fame in Canton, Ohio. Recognizing the Troopers as the winningest team in professional football history.
It's one of those really fantastic stories that's lost in history, and even people in Toledo don't know about them. So it's crazy. I mean, at that time, these women were paid $25 a week to be on the team. Right. So there's definitely some feminist auras to this film that are really exciting. Plus, they're hilarious. So I think this is a really fun and entertaining documentary with some serious notes to it, and also a chance to learn about a piece of our Ohio history that a lot of people don't know about.
Another documentary that's directed by a Northeast Ohio native, Todd Thompson, is looking at the origins of the Beatles. Tell us a bit about Prefab.
Prefab is another documentary that is fun because of the subject. So Colin Hanton, another person I knew nothing about, who was actually the original drummer for a band called the Quarrymen in the 1950s, which later turned into the Beatles. So we've even played Beatles documentaries at our festival before, but I never knew about this part of it. And the fact that Todd made this film and he's so excited about it. He'll be at the festival as well for the Q&A. It is really exciting. And Colin is a character. Him and his wife together are hilarious.
Cool. Citizen Sleuth has been getting some buzz, I've noticed, recently showed at South by Southwest. This documentary takes a critical look at true crime podcasting. In following Emily Nestor, she self-investigated the death of a woman from Marietta. Ought to get people talking.
Yes. So this is a film made by two Cleveland natives, Chris Kasich, who is the director originally from Cleveland. We played his film Uncle Nick back in, I think, 2015. He was at the festival. And then Tyler Davidson, who is a well-known producer originally from Cleveland. He helped make The Land, among some other very popular films. They are also going to be at the festival along with Emily Nestor, the main subject in the film. And I can't wait to meet her. This, I would say, is probably one of the hardest films in our festival to describe, because in some ways, like, the synopsis was a hard one for us to nail down because it's telling one story for most of the film and there's a big twist, which I'm not going to give away. But I think it's a great examination into a big part of our culture and what seems maybe on the surface level in terms of just people liking true crime podcasts, but how there's a lot of layers underneath that. And it's also telling it from a pretty entertaining person as well. Emily herself is somebody to reckon with, I think. And it definitely kind of gives an angle of true crime itself in the film, which I love how Chris made this film because it is a documentary, but he does it in such an appropriate way that as a viewer, you're sort of engaged in that true crime sense. And then there's kind of a little bit of mystery around the story too, which I don't want to give away. So I'm not going to say too much.
Totally different topic. There's Food and Country, which is looking at the U.S. food supply chain. So this includes some local voices. What can you share about Food and Country?
So this is a documentary that just premiered at Sundance that I was lucky to see there. We have a couple documentaries in the festival this year in our global health competition that sort of take a different look at what's happening to the food industry in terms of farmers specifically. And this one really looks at especially what happened during the pandemic for many independent farmers, for restaurateurs and the food industry in general, and how a lot of these sort of grassroots entities were taken advantage of by larger conglomerates. So it's a global topic. It focuses on places within the United States. And then specifically one of the stories they share is about Bob and Lee Jones and their small farm based in Huron, Ohio. And Bob and Lee will be at the festival as well. And so they'll be here for the Q&A, which is going to be really great just to hear about what they've gone through in the last few years and to really examine, even on a political level, what is happening to the farming and food industry in our country at this point.
One of the several Ukrainian films that are showing at the festival is an animated children's movie, Mavka. This story seems like it will truly have wide appeal.
Yes, as you might imagine, there's a lot of heavy films in this sidebar this year. We have 8 feature films and a shorts program as well. So to be able to offer something that comes from the country that is lighthearted and uplifting is really great. So Mavka, the forest song, it's really beautiful animation. It's a kids film that will be playing the first Saturday around noon. And right before that, we'll have a family activity scheduled in our chat room space, which is at Playhouse Square. And before that, we'll have a family shorts program. So Saturday mornings are really for families to come down and bring small children. I know my 4-year-old will be coming to watch the shorts and Mavka on Saturday.
I am not a demon. I am Mavka, the soul of the forest.
I'm not so sure he came back from the forest empty-handed.
I knew that all humans were selfish and greedy.
But they also gave me something I've never felt before.
Another Ukrainian film, Pomfir, is a family-centered story. It's about a father trying to be there for his family despite so many different adversities. What did you like about that film?
So centered around a family, but this is not a family film, I will say. It's actually one of my favorite films in our festival this year. It's a debut filmmaker who, especially after you watch the film, it's just amazing that this is his first film. It's in our After Hours program. It's a little darker of a thriller for sure. It is visually stunning. Probably one of the most beautiful, some of the most beautiful cinematography we have in any of the films in this year's festival. And the lead character comes back from working in Poland for a long time to make money for his family. And they live in a small rural town in Western Ukraine. And because of forces out of his control, he has to do some work that he doesn't want to be doing that's not safe anymore, but he's trying to provide for his family. And it's kind of got the, you know, undertones of sort of an organized crime thriller set in Western Ukraine. So that's a later night film, but definitely one that I think people will be talking about at this year's festival.
There are also a couple of Ukrainian films that really ought to give people more perspective directly about war in Ukraine. Can you talk a little bit about what you hope audiences might take away from seeing A Rising Fury and 20 Days in Mariupol?
So A Rising Fury, that premiered at Tribeca last June, and 20 Days in Mariupol just premiered at Sundance. However, the difference between those two documentaries is sort of the timing. Both of them are incredibly enlightening into what's actually happening in Ukraine and the war against that country at this time. 20 Days in Mariupol is just that. It's the first 20 days of the war, essentially. And it's all footage from a group of Associated Press journalists. The director is one of them. The fact, when you watch that film, how horrific it is then, and to think about it's been a year of that, is just, I remember leaving that theater, I guess, more moved than any other film I've watched this year. So, and I think A Rising Fury is a really great partner film to that because it gives a lot more context, right? So it's a film that was shot over 8 years, because some people might not know that this war has been actually going on for a lot longer. But I think that this film in particular really taught me a lot about the complications and the complexities of this war and where things first started.
Having viewed so many of these different films for this whole festival, do you get excited about revisiting them with people, with all the people that come through?
Oh, yes. I mean, I love this question. I sometimes forget to tell people this when I'm talking to them about the festival, because my favorite part of the festival is for the films that I hold really close to my heart is to stand at the back of the theaters once the film goes on. And I don't always have time to do this because I'm running around the festival putting fires out everywhere. But when I can, for specific films, I love to stand at the back and just kind of take it all in and think about the role we play as curators at the festival of bringing these films to our city, being able to share them with our community. And that's just, I feel really grateful for that. And it's really my dream come true, is my job to be able to do that.
Thank you so much for running through so many films, giving us a nice preview.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me.
That was Cleveland International Film Festival Artistic Director Mallory Martin talking with IdeaStream's Carrie Wise about a sampling of some of the many different films that are screening this year. The Cleveland International Film Festival kicks off Wednesday night in Playhouse Square, continues in person until April 2nd, then the film viewing moves online for yet another week. We're going to take a quick break right here. When we return, we'll highlight one of the 320 films you'll see at this year's festival. It's a documentary called Nurse Unseen that tells the story of Filipino nurses at the front lines of the pandemic. You're listening to The Sound of Ideas. We'll be right back. It is The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Rick Jackson. Let's dive back into the Cleveland International Film Festival, which kicks off tomorrow evening. It's common for Filipino Americans to pursue careers in nursing. There are cultural reasons, but also historically significant reasons for this as well. Nurses across the United States were, of course, on the front lines of the COVID-19 pandemic. Filipino American nurses were adversely affected, seeing a higher death rate at the heights of the pandemic relative to other nursing demographics. A documentary titled Nurse Unseen dives into the experience of Filipino American nurses over the past few years. The documentary is making its world premiere at CIF this Sunday, March 26th, 5 p.m. in the KeyBank State Theater. Joining us to discuss Nurse Unseen is the documentary filmmaker Michelle Hosway, calling in from Los Angeles. Good morning, and thank you for getting up so early.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Great. Also by telephone, we have Rose Ferguson, the nurse manager at North Shore Gastroenterology and secretary of the Philippine Nurses Association of Ohio. Thank you for being here, Rose.
Thanks so much for having us here this morning.
We did have the president of the association set for this segment as well. She's been called into overtime work at the emergency room. Just goes to show how important and vital nurses truly are. Now, if you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call, 866-578-0903. You may email us, soi@ideastream.org. You may tweet us. We are @SoundOfIdeas. Finally, you can text in a question or comment, 216-916-6478. Michelle, you're based in L.A. The Filipino population there clearly much higher than in Northeast Ohio, but still, you like the idea of premiering the film at the Cleveland International Film Festival. You have history here?
I do. I do often say that the Cleveland International Film Festival is my most favorite film festival I've ever been to. This is where I screen Matt Shepard is a Friend of Mine, which is my feature documentary. And it was one of the first festivals in the United States to screen that film. And I just felt so supported, and I love the CIF community. I was also invited to be a juror in a subsequent festival. So I really feel close ties to this community. So it's really special for me to be able to bring this film, which is personal to myself, to a community that means so much to me.
You had to be thrilled when they said, yes, this is one of the films we want, because we know they get thousands of submissions.
Oh my gosh, absolutely. It's always such an honor, and it's wonderful and so meaningful to have our world premiere at this festival. Mm-hmm. So we are very, very excited.
Rose, I know other nurses and other Filipinos in the region must be excited to have this premiering here.
Oh, we are thrilled to have the world premiere here in Cleveland in our hometown. We do have a lot of Filipino nurses here, and they were working on the front lines during the pandemic. A huge number of nurses work at the Cleveland Clinic in critical care, so it's a perfect place to premiere the film.
I would imagine because it is the world premiere, you'd have other nurses, other Filipino Americans coming in from out of town for the movie?
Yes, we do. I think we have some from the executive board of our national group.
Michelle, what sparked the idea? I mean, I read the news item of it, that there were so many more nurses of the Filipino persuasion dying during the pandemic. Where'd the idea come from for you?
The seed of this film was planted many, many years ago. I mean, my aunt was a pediatric nurse at Children's Hospital. She was essentially like our second mom. So nursing is really indelible to my personal history. She had passed several years ago. And as a filmmaker, I was always kind of reflecting on ways I could honor her. But it was when the pandemic hit that it sort of really started to take place for me. And I knew I wanted to honor her in this way, seeing just how much our Filipino nurses were sacrificing and caring for us during this time. But then when the National Nurses United study came out in late 2020 that spelled out how even though Filipino nurses make up only 4% of the registered nursing workforce in the United States, at one point they made up over 31.5% of the COVID nurse deaths. So that was the data, that was the study that really kicked the whole film into high gear. And I knew this is something I had to make for my aunt and for all those Filipino frontline workers.
It makes sense that you do it in California because you're there. But as I'm watching, you keep bouncing back and forth to Manhattan, to the Bronx, and to Los Angeles. Why New York?
Yes, I mean, there's Filipinos everywhere and Filipino healthcare workers and nurses literally all around the world. So it would be quite hard, you know, to make this film. So we had to put parameters, like certain structures in place so that it was manageable for us. So we decided to focus on the West Coast and, you know, Los Angeles primarily, and then the New York, New Jersey area, given that those are the highest concentration of Filipino nurses in the United States.
Rose, put us in those shoes. For you and your peers working not in L.A., but here, what was it like working, knowing you're battling this virus that's taking away your friends?
It was frightening. We definitely didn't have the rules in place because it was a new virus. We had no rules about it. And sometimes you have to make real-world decisions before you have the conclusive evidence of what's right. And we were battling that. We were battling you know, people not wanting to comply with these things, political opinions about it, which made it harder on us as well. But what Michelle said is so true about New York, because at the time that this was happening, you know, everybody splintered and no one was meeting. But our national president, she and her husband both fell ill, and her husband passed away right at the height of the pandemic. And so we were meeting virtually, the executive board of which I was part of at the time, and she was meeting from her hospital bed virtually after her husband's in intensive care, you know, a couple floors away, and then he passed away. I mean, it was tragic. I'm still tearing up thinking about it right now. It was tragic.
I think we all know people who were hurt by the virus. I knew people who passed away from the virus. But when you realize that it's targeting us, you know, the virus isn't picky, but it's killing Filipino nurses, that discussion had to be difficult each and every day.
It was. It was so hard. And to know that we were, you know, pretty much sacrificial lambs. And I don't mean to say that it was intentional in any way,
right,
shape, or form. But the Filipino nurses are always working in critical care areas. It's just in our nature, I suppose. I worked in critical care locally here at the Cleveland Clinic when I first started out. So I think that was part of the research was found that among many factors was that Filipino nurses highly represented in critical care areas, which is where you'd be most exposed to the virus.
And Michelle, you have a scene in there where a nurse is saying they told us specifically not to wear a mask because we don't want to scare the patients.
Yes, that's correct. So we have the daughter of the first healthcare worker to pass in Los Angeles County, and she shared with us that her mother, Rosary Castro Olega, was told specifically not to wear a mask, and this was in the beginning days of the pandemic. That was the policy at the hospital at that time. Obviously, things have changed, but in retrospect, you know, that was the wrong decision.
And Michelle, there's a lot of topics in the documentary that are things we've seen in news coverage, but many AAPIs, Asian Americans, Pacific Islanders, feel that the historical moments are often forgotten after the news cycle. Is that part of this film? We want to preserve these sometimes forgotten moments in AAPI history.
Yes, I mean, that's an incredibly insightful question. I couldn't, you know, put it better myself. I mean, that's the mission of the whole film, to really document this moment in time for our community and beyond our community. So, you know, people that aren't Filipino can understand in a more emotional and humanistic way, like what we're going through. And then also looking back, the historical context of why all of this is playing out. I was never taught in school about the Philippine American history. You know, it was like a footnote in our history books that the U.S. colonized the Philippines. But then really learning how they designed this sort of pipeline that allowed so many Filipino nurses to be trained in the American model and then were inspired to immigrate to the U.S. I mean, that's history that's playing out in our lives today that is present within all of us every single moment. So to document that in this film is incredibly important. And I thought, well, if no one else is going to do it, my team and I could do it. Mm-hmm. You know, we're going to make this film for our community so people can learn.
And we have second and third generation Americans whose grandmothers were Filipino nurses who came here in that pipeline.
Absolutely. I mean, I come from a family of a long line of nurses. My great grandmother came to the U.S. on a boat to be a nurse. And then my grandmother was a nurse, aunts, cousins. And this is not a unique story to my family. So many Filipino American nurses have a similar family story. And so that's why it was important for me to tell this story across the generations so people can really understand the legacy of Filipino nurses.
If you have questions for the nurses or comments about the work they do, 866-578-0903 is the number to call. Michelle, there are also some ugly parts of the documentary, and I don't mean cinematographically, but the increase of racism fueled by the coronavirus. We see Asian Americans being scapegoated, being blamed, and nurses weren't immune to that.
Yeah, I understand what you mean. I thought it was just necessary to showcase because this was unfortunate fallout from the pandemic and the political nature of some things. So it just was very bitterly ironic to understand that, you know, Filipino nurses, Asian American frontline workers and healthcare workers were caring for us, literally risking their lives in the hospital to make sure that we were surviving and okay. But then out on the streets, you know, being afraid for their lives. And we've showcased some news stories and headlines that show that nurses were also attacked. So it's a necessary part of the story to share that this is a unfortunate fallout from the COVID-19 pandemic.
Right, Rose, I think that was happening here. I can remember news stories of nurses who didn't want to wear their scrubs home because they were afraid to be ID'd.
Yeah, it definitely occurred here. And also just challenging, constantly challenging. I had, in 30 years of nursing, I had never had patients so many times challenge the what we were doing medically. I mean, usually if the doctor says this is the order and the nurse says I'm going to do this, you know, patients will accept it and, you know, believe that we're acting in their best interest. But to be constantly challenged about everything was just very disheartening. There were wonderful, heartening things that happened where people said, thank you so much, and we appreciate what you're doing. But to be constantly challenged on things was really hard, and I had never experienced that in nursing before.
Rose, despite that difficulty, does the spirit of the Filipino nurses still prevail?
Oh, of course. Absolutely. We are a service oriented people. We've always been service oriented, not just in medical field. You know, we've always been, because we export our labor and we send our money back to the Philippines, you'll find people in service in cruise ships and, you know, all kinds of service industries. So we are service oriented people, and we are glad and happy to serve to help people get better and have good health.
Michelle, as I mentioned, I've seen the film already. One of our reporters, Gabriel Kramer, who you know is Filipino-American, he also saw an advanced screening in the doc, and he was saying he felt attached to the stories in the documentary, like he was watching his family in some ways. You have to feel similar attachment, I think you've said. People deserve to have their stories told.
Absolutely. Gabriel's been so great and an advocate for the film. So that's really, that makes me tear up just to hear that, because that's my highest hope for the film, that people watch it and feel that that's their family up on screen. I mean, it's really something to see a Filipino story, Filipino faces, Filipino family members, nurses up there and really centered, you know, on a mainstream platform to be at the Cleveland International Film Festival. That's a really big deal. And it just validates so much of our personal experiences. So it's a beautiful thing. I'm very, very excited and honored to be able to present the film, not only virtually, but, you know, with people in a real room. And to feel that energy and to just be all together to celebrate the contributions of Filipino nurses all together.
You know, I wanted to bring up that point. You could have sent this documentary to a lot of places, streaming services, but you chose the film festival route. It may be less advantageous, you know, when it comes to money in your pocket, but that connection.
Yes, it's not the easiest or most lucrative route. That speaks to my indie roots, but it's, I think, you know, we made this film for our community, and, you know, several members of our film team are nurses themselves. So it was just our mission to be able to share it with our community, and to do that through community screenings, film festival screenings, so that we would have that chance to really be in a room all together to discuss and to commemorate and to honor all the decades of contributions and sacrifices our Filipino nurses have made to the U.S. healthcare system.
Rose, as we said, Ohio doesn't have the same type Filipino populations, other parts of America, but that strong sense of Filipino solidarity, it exists not just for the nursing cohort here, but for all Filipino Americans here?
Yes, we do have a Filipino American society. We have a cultural center. We just got approved to establish a cultural garden, which we're very excited about. So you'll see us at One World Day if you're heading down there in August. But we do have a very active Filipino community. A lot of it is tied to our Catholic roots. So we have a Philippine American ministry. We have, you know, just many groups here. So yeah, we're well represented. And the Filipino American Nurses Association, we have three chapters in Ohio, Cleveland, Columbus, and Cincinnati, of course.
Last word to you, Michelle. What do you want people to take away from this film?
I think that I would love for non-Filipinos to understand and have a better appreciation of what our nurses contribute to the healthcare system. And I think that would give them a better appreciation for all that we do. And hopefully that will combat the resurgence of anti-Asian hate that we're seeing. That's my biggest hope. And then for Filipinos, just to see that film, like Gabriel Kramer, to see that film and feel that that's a genuine replication of their story, and for them to feel validated and empowered. Those are my highest hopes for the film.
Filmmaker Michelle Hossaway of Nurse Unseen, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Rose Ferguson's with the Philippine Nurses Association of Ohio. Thank you as well.
Thank you so much. And thanks, Michelle.
Thanks, Rose.
We will look forward to the world premiere of Nurse Unseen again at Sunday, March 26th, 5 o'clock, KeyBank State Theater, part of the Cleveland International Film Festival. Nurse Unseen will play again Monday, that's the 27th, I believe at 11:50 in the morning. Well, to get the last word on today's topics, please send an email, SOI at ideastream.org. We're on Twitter at Sound of Ideas. You can follow me there at RickJ903. Tomorrow on the Sound of Ideas, we'll talk to employment lawyer Anne-Marie Ahern about a host of workplace issues going on in the country right now, tackling child labor laws, non-compete agreements. She'll answer your questions as well. And we'll highlight a series of films also being shown at CIFF that come from BIPOC filmmakers telling stories about the Midwest. If you missed any portion of our program today, you can find us online or listen to the Sound of Ideas podcast. You can also hear a rebroadcast tonight at 9, 89.7 WKSU. I'm Rick Jackson. Thank you for listening. We'll talk to you again tomorrow.